Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
All right, for the next few weeks, every Wednesday, we are going to bring you a series of conversations on leadership. We call it Stepping Up, and we will talk to local people who are making deep changes in their communities. Listen, as we all try to move forward from 2 years of isolation and we're stitching our communities back together as we re-enter the world, it feels like the right moment to ask, what does real leadership look like now? Not just in politics, but education, religion, nonprofit work. And the best way to answer that question is to talk with people who are walking the walk about what stepping up takes, the biggest challenges or obstacles that might keep someone from stepping up, and how we can all help clear the path for that next leader to take that step. So first up today and here with us in Studio 2, Doug Rao. He is the founder of the nonprofit grocery chain Daily Table. Doug spent 31 years with Trader Joe's, the last 14 as president, and he was the one responsible for bringing what was a small California chain, kind of a competitor to 7-Eleven, to the East Coast and into the kind of juggernaut that Trader Joe's became in the industry. However, it is the moment after that where we're basically going to start today. Doug Rao, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you. And I just, for full transparency, want to note you're on a number of nonprofit boards. WBUR's Boards of Overseers is one of those. Okay, so I want you to take us back to that moment. Your time with Trader Joe's is coming to a close after building really an empire. What's on your mind at that time?
That's a great question. When I graduated from Trader Joe's, I called it that because I was 56 and I was just ready for a change. I didn't know what I was going to do. I knew that I wanted to continue to be engaged because I knew that traditional retirement really wasn't going to be the satisfying payout window for me. And so I happened to have an opportunity at that time to participate in a brand new program at Harvard called the Advanced Leadership Initiative. So I did this two-year fellowship there. And out of that, got to do a deep dive into one of the social challenges that we face, which is around hunger. It's around nutritional insecurity or food insecurity. And so my thought when I was looking to transition from Trader Joe's, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew I wanted to still be engaged, and I knew it was probably going to be in some nonprofit realm. Originally, I thought I'd just sit on boards, but that wasn't very satisfying for someone who'd been so operational their career. And so when the opportunity to do the fellowship at Harvard came up, what drew me to that one was that it has as a condition, at the end of it, you're going to stand and deliver in front of your cohort and the faculty. What are you going to do about a problem?
So there are a couple things I want to dig into there. And I want to note, that's when I met you, was when you were through that. And we talked a number of times in those couple of years. So two things. One, as you entered that program with this sort of victorious run at Trader Joe's under your belt, who did you think you were as a leader at that stage in your career?
Wow. Yeah. I thought that I was someone who had better lucky than good, been at the right time, at the right spot with getting to meet Joe Colombe, Trader Joe, and then getting to meet Peter Drucker and do the Drucker Institute. And
management specialist, famous management guru.
Yep, and I got the chance to get my executive MBA with him. It turned out he was a big Trader Joe's fan, so we had many conversations about that. And I thought I was someone who was a fairly creative leader, someone who was a very capable leader, but I also by then started to discover, as we all do as we get older in life, that there were a number of things I wasn't very good at or I didn't enjoy very much. So it turned out one of them was I didn't really enjoy managing, and lots of details.
I'm sorry, that out, just kind of surprises me.
Well, I liked the idea of having a challenge and going to solve it. Like, hey, how are we going to grow Trader Joe's out of California? You know, so you write the business plan, which I did, present it to central management and the owners. They approved it. And then it's like, okay, lead forth the charge to Boston and then grow it throughout the East. And it was this, can it be done, sort of, you know, and get that. Once it's up and really running, I don't think I have any great expertise in that. I think I'm okay, but not, you know, nothing outstanding. I think I'd come to realize I don't really actually enjoy that. And so it was really one of those things where, well, where could I lean into next that would be something I'd really enjoy, where I might be able to also take my learnings and my experience and put it to best use.
Okay, so that was the other piece on this that I wanted to ask you, because that was a time in the nonprofit world where the nonprofit sector here in Boston specifically, although other places as well, was beginning to recoil from the thought that people who had been successful in business could just come in and fix things in these complex organizations or complex social problems.
Yeah.
So did you just think you could come in and fix things at that time?
No, I really did. I didn't. As you know, Tiziana, that's why I sought out people in that. And at that time, you happened to have a position with a nonprofit, very well respected. And I sought
Boston
out
Rising
your advice, as you know. I sought out, as I did for many people. I thought that I fortunately was just lucky enough to know I don't really understand this world very well. And I also was quick enough to learn that, oh, the nonprofit world has a little different rule book than the for-profit world. You've got to engage far more, shall we say, you've got to get agreement and support from different stakeholders, whether it be the community. You know, usually if you're going to put a grocery store in a community, you don't go out and ask them, is it okay if we do this? You put it in, and then you welcome them, et cetera. But you don't have to go out and, like, get as many stakeholders' approval as when you're going to go do some social work. You usually have to, you know, engage with whether it be the political will, the community's will, making sure that there's enough of the resources in the community supporting this, because nonprofits run off of the support of a community in a little different way, I think, than the average for-profit.
Okay, so I'm going to pause there, and we're going to carve out some time here to talk about Daily Table for our listeners. Because I can imagine a listener saying, wait, I don't understand how a grocery store is social work, right? Mm-hmm. So let's start with what Daily Table is now.
Okay. So Daily Table is a nonprofit retail grocery store that is committed to and dedicated to bring affordable, healthy, nutritious food down into communities that otherwise might struggle to afford that. So as it turns out, part of the research that I did at Harvard really revealed that hunger in America is not so much a shortage of calories for the 49 million food insecure. It's a shortage of nutrients. It's that the stomachs are full, but they're full of basically higher processed, calorically dense, but nutritionally poor foods.
Because those are inexpensive and
they're
easily
very
accessible.
Expensive. Exactly. So the challenge is, how do we bring these communities, the fruits, the vegetables, the fresh produce, the clean dairy and protein, the particularly grab-and-go meals that aren't high in sodium, high in sugar, deeply, you know, processed or fried, how do we bring that in an affordable manner? Because there is no, quote, disposable income. We often talk about, you know, what part of your disposable income goes to food? Well, if you get to below the middle class and even the middle class today, there's not much you can talk about as disposable. It's trade-off income. And I know you've worked with this and you know this yourself, that it was really an understanding for me. It was going out and talking to the community and getting an understanding of how can we best help. So Daily Table today, in many ways, it's a hunger relief agency that masquerades as a corner food store.
I just want you to say that a second time.
Okay. We are 100% committed to hunger relief work, but we masquerade as a community food store. And the reason we do that, it wasn't my initial intention, like, oh, he did a retailer, Trader Joe's. Of course, he went and did a retail store. I actually had no intention of doing that. I had met with Catherine D'Amato, the wonderful head of Greater Boston Food Bank, which does great work. And my hope was to go around, collect all this food, extra food from the grocers in the area, bring it down to them, have them distribute it, and hunger would be solved. I was naive. I was uneducated on the real challenges of hunger. And it was in a conversation I had with Vicky Escara, who was the CEO of Feeding America at the time. And I had 2-hour-long conversations with her and her team. And it was in one of those conversations when I was asked, what's your biggest problem? And she said, 38% of the population that qualifies for our services don't use them. And when I started with this, was it because they're not aware of it? Is it marketing? Is it you don't have enough locations? Is it language? Is it distribution? Like, oh, Doug, no, it's so much simpler than that. They're ashamed.
Stigma.
They're embarrassed. So it's that idea of how do we create a way to engage with people in need that will give them a sense of agency, that will put the power in their hands instead of feeling I'm getting a handout. And the thing about retail that's nice is it's voluntary exchange. So they choose to come to us. We got to earn their patronage. So although we're a nonprofit, in essence, hunger relief, trying to really bring affordable nutrition to communities and people that otherwise couldn't have it, we need to do it in a manner that engenders a feeling of agency, like I can provide for my family. And second, does it in a dignified way because they have the power of the purse. We got to earn their patronage every day. And I like that. So that's, but, and we also, one of the things that's really important is we hire from the community. We pay living wage, both Boston's living wage and also in Cambridge City's living wage. We believe very much that all of us together can get this done, none of us alone. So we engage with lots of other organizations that we partner with.
All right. So, and today at Daily Table, you guys work really hard to make it possible for someone to purchase enough nutritious food for a family of, I think it's four or a family of two, on a budget of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, on a SNAP budget.
Yeah. So we test this. We just did this again recently where sort of the litmus test of are we delivering on our mission? Because anyone could be a low-cost retailer, you know, a grocer, and there's many of them, and there are many of them doing good work. But the question is, as the litmus test, could someone who's on SNAP, and they're literally, that's their only form of income, is I just have SNAP, and I have to use that to buy food. And anyone that's done the SNAP challenge, like our wonderful Congressman Jim McGovern, who's done this several times, and he's written about it, how tough it is. By the time you get about halfway through the second or third week, you're out of money, and you start eating foods you know are going to damage your health. So, what we do is a litmus test where we check to make certain that you can get 2,000 calories, which is the USDA recommended allowance for the average adult. You can get 2,000 calories of healthy food, balanced with nutrition, not too high in sodium, et cetera, good fiber, protein. And we can get you to the end of the month with money in your pocket.
Okay.
And we just validated that again. So that's the one distinctive factor, perhaps. We also have programs like Double Up Food Bucks, where people can come in if they're on SNAP, they get 2-for-1 on produce and things like that.
So, Doug, now I want to backtrack a little bit again, and I appreciate that carve out for people to understand the business, the operation of Daily Table. Part of the reason we were so interested in talking to you for this leadership series is because you changed your mind. You changed your understanding, and that was core to changing your approach. So I want to go back to when you started with this idea before Daily Table was really built. Hey, there's a lot of food out there that has technically expired but was still good. Let's put that out for people. And the pushback that you got in low-income communities saying no. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that was well, fortunately, again, as I said, I had good luck of asking enough people and gathering with enough people and then going to enough community gatherings, probably 15 or 20 neighborhood meetings.
Where it became, in what neighborhoods?
These were in Dorchester and Roxbury. Primarily, those were the two that we were really focused on. And what became very clear was I'd say 80% of the population said, okay, I get it. All right, yeah, that sounds interesting. Yeah, we like the idea in theory about us going and gathering food that would be just at or past its code date, but perfectly good food. Like, and we all know that if bread, you know, if it's not moldy, you eat it. It's good. No one even knows what the code date of bread is usually. And the same with so many other food products and produce, et cetera. So the idea was go collect this food because then we could get it basically donated to us for free and turn around and sell it for pennies on the dollar. And what we ran into was about 15 or 20% of the population felt profoundly, strongly, why do we always get the seconds? Why do we get the salvage and everyone else's hand-me-downs or you know, the stuff that's basically dumpster dive? And we said, whoa, this is a strong enough part of the community, very vocal, that it ran right into that dignity issue. And we started then pushing in on that and realizing, you know, to deliver on our primary directive of a dignified exchange, we're going to have to forego this idea of going out and getting food and selling it past its code date because not one in 100 Americans understand code dates. And certainly in this community, they're going to look at that as these are second-rate products. I got it. And it took, I mean, it really was an awakening for me, and it changed our business model. It made it much more difficult, of course, but it did change the fact that, you know, since then, for the last 7 years, so in a couple of weeks, we'll be open 7 years now in our first Dorchester site, that we've not sold product past this. We sell only product within code, only product that someone, if they bought it, would feel I'm getting a first-rate, you know, first-rate product that I can get anywhere else.
All right. So now let's move into some of the leadership's lessons here from this transformation, which from afar, as I watched you, really struck me as developing a commitment to quality that was separated from perceptions about income, deserving neighborhood. Everyone deserves quality.
Right.
What was stupid hard when you tried to step up in this space that just shouldn't have been? One of the things that we're trying to learn is, where do we make it hard for people to step up? And we just shouldn't.
Yeah. Well, I'd say there were probably two things. One was preconceived notions. They're, you know, you don't even know you have them until you run into them, you know, until reality, you know, gives you a whack on the head. So a lot of preconceived notions. And some of it are preconceived notions, by the way, that are out there that other people have told me. Like, I'd read over and over again that, you know, well, once people unfortunately get, you know, raised or addicted to a diet that's high in sugar and processed foods, it's just impossible to get it to change.
So other people's preconceived notions or
exactly.
bad beliefs,
which I bought
about
into,
what the situation is or what was possible.
Yeah. So I also, of course, read that and go, oh, boy, what do we have to do? We're going to have a teaching kitchen and we're going to have to do this and that. And it turns out that we now know from experience that if you simply remove the economic barrier, that a large part of the population will go, I'll definitely increase produce in my diet. And we actually have studies to show that that happens. I mean, really good, rigorous studies done by the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition showing that 27% more produce per visit is purchased through the Double Up Food Buck program. That people that were on SNAP before we introduced it and then after bought on average 27% more produce just because the economics.
Because when they could, they made great choices.
That's right. Exactly. So and then we also know among this population from lots of data that they tend to, if they buy it, if they choose it, they use it because they can't afford to waste food. That, in other words, they may not buy it a second time or third time, but if they're buying produce, they're tending to use it. So that's important.
So those were some tropes, so basically.
Yeah. So one is just the preconceived notions. The second is that and this sounds sort of, but how tough it is when there's not a goal line, when there's not a clear and an immediate goal line of success. So I had lots of ideas about success, like, well, when we're economically viable. Well, for nonprofits fighting hunger, that's almost impossible. It's very hard to find anybody in America that's doing that. But I had this idea we'd have these stores and they'd become, you know,
self-sustaining,
break even. I mean, obviously there's no shareholders that are going to return anything. We're nonprofit, but they'd be sustainable. And that's been far tougher than we thought because it runs into the dynamic of either you're going to offer low, low, low prices, yet food often costs more, and also you're paying living wage, et cetera. So you end up with, we're going to cover a lot, and we do. We're world class on covering, you know, 65, 70% of our expenses, but we have to count on the grace of the community and the philanthropic world to keep us going. And that's something that is new and it was different. So I think there's the fact that this is a long marathon, not a 50 or 100-yard dash, that it's not a dash to profitability or a dash to some silver bullet, that this is part of a systemic problem in America. And as systemic problems, they're incredibly entrenched and difficult to deal with. And that you need to get your inspiration and encouragement from the daily small wins, the fact that every time someone comes in.
Yeah, let's stay there. So let's wrap on this idea of the long marathon, because part of our focus in these conversations is how do communities show up so that that leader takes the step, yeah, stays in the game. So what kept you in the game? 7 years. Now, almost, since you were, yeah, opened that first store, several years getting to the point of opening that store, how has your community kept you in the game?
You know, that's a great question. If I reflect on that, I'd have to say it's probably two things. One is having been raised as a kid who had himself a dad who was going to college, getting his doctorate, his master and doctorate, all the time up until I was 10, 11 years old, last week of the month was thin. You know, we were poor. We were struggling students, grad student kids, right? And I remember what it's like to be hungry. I remember what it's like to not, you know, have much to eat. So there's that intellectual part of my brain. It's also down in my body. But more importantly, what really keeps me going is the whenever we walk into a store and you see the faces of kids, you have customers tell you how much it means to them and their life. And I've had people tell me stories that are really, truly goosebump experiences where what this has done for them and what this has done personally into their life, et cetera. Those are the things when you can see that impact.
You got to tell us one of those stories.
Well, I mean, gosh, there's so many. Okay, so so one is a gentleman came in and he had just been down to Cobham Square Health Center right down the street, and he had his annual visit. And he came back in and he said, I just want to let you guys know that I've been shopping here almost every day since you've opened because I've just replaced what I was eating for lunch with your prepared meals. And I've lost 75 pounds. I said, whoa, that's fantastic. He says, no. But the doctor says that whatever I'm doing, keep doing it because I'm now off of my diabetic medication. I was pre-diabetic. I was headed down this path. I was that close to becoming diabetic. I've turned the corner. He says, you can stop taking it. Whatever, just keep doing what you're doing. He said, you got your life back. And tears welled up in his eyes. And there's a great big, it was about 6'4" or 6'5", great big guy. And like, you know, can I give you a hug sort of thing. It was one of those experiences where you just went, this is what it's about. It's that ability to, success is one individual at a time. And I think in the nonprofit world, sometimes we get too enamored by how many millions of pounds were recovered or how many tens of thousands of this, that, but what really keeps you going, I mean, the everyday grind, because this is tough work, is that person to person, looking someone in the eye and realizing, if there's any way I can possibly be of service and help you help your family and yourself, it's all worth it.
All right. And that is Doug Rau, founder and president of Daily Table and the former president of Trader Joe's. Doug, really appreciate your time. Thanks for having the conversation with us.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you. Listeners, we'll do another Stepping Up next Wednesday.